Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I am your host for this weekend's edition. Also your host throughout the week on our website and podcast, kereport.com and Corlin Economics Report. Please be sure to follow us and check in on a daily basis because boy oh boy, it's been a very busy week and a very busy year. All kinds of, especially company interviews and a lot of analysis focused on markets and metals. And this weekend show, well, we have to focus on the metals and the pretty drastic sell-off that we saw this week on the back of the Fed statement. And in all fairness, metals, commodities broadly were pretty volatile even heading into this week, way more volatile than equity markets. So that could have been a contributing factor. Either way, I'm going to spend a lot of time on that, and I am kicking off the show with Adrian Day, president of Adrian Day Asset Management, also manages the Euro-Pacific Gold Fund. Now, as a note here, Adrian and I are talking about halfway through the day on Thursday, so as of right now, not a good day for gold, and quite frankly, just in the last 3 days of trading, gold is down over $100, and quite a ways off, about $150 off of that high from the very beginning of this month, right around 1920. Adrian, is it as simple as the Fed talking about getting more dovish, even though the dot plot moved a couple years down the road? Is that what's driving this correction in gold?
Yeah, well, good morning, Corey. And as you and I were joking before the show, we should stop booking these interviews in advance because it seems every time we book an interview, gold collapses.
So, it's true. And we book these things like a month, 2 months in advance, yeah, too. But it's eerie.
It happened last time, didn't it? And it's a lot more fun to be talking when things are up. But I think the advice is, if my advice is of value to anyone, the advice is more valuable than when things are not working out well. You know, I think clearly the Fed was the trigger, and also more than that, it was the fundamental factor driving. So it was the primary factor driving. As you mentioned, the commodities in general were volatile heading into this. Gold itself was really a lot less volatile than the other commodities, frankly. And, you know, I think we'd had a situation. I was looking at the graph. You go back to the low, the bottom for gold, the bottom in early March. Although we came back to that low a month later, we have not had more than two consecutive down days. So we've had 2 days down, but we haven't had more than two consecutive days down until this week. Well, until last week, sorry. So gold had been really remarkably strong. I mean, it was obviously a good move up, a good recovery move, but also not having a meaningful correction this whole way up. And so I think that set the tone for gold to react, you know, the way it did to the Fed statement. Now, I mean, obviously a lot of people have commented on this, but I mean, my gosh, the Fed is talking about, you know, raising rates 2 years out. You know, the headline to me should have been, Fed won't raise rates for at least 2 years, says Powell. I mean, that's the headline. In the current environment, rates are ridiculously low and should be higher. I'm not saying I want them higher, but they should be higher. And so the real headline to me is that the Fed isn't going to do anything for 2 years. That would have been bullish for gold. But of course, the way it's written, Fed to raise rates, and you look at all of the things in the Fed statement, the Fed comments, and the market simply focused on the fact that, you know, they said they were going to raise rates 2 years from now. They didn't focus on Powell conceding that inflation is higher than anticipated, not just higher, higher and more persistent, he said. You know, this is interesting because after the full dress court of, you know, all of the different Fed spokesmen and regional chairmen and everybody else coming in, coming out saying it's just transitory, it's just transitory, it's a base effect from last April, don't worry about it. Now, for the first time, they're admitting, well, maybe it's more persistent, more persistent than we thought it was. The fact that the Fed says we're in new territory, new waters, by the way, into which Powell, as captain of the boat, steered us. You know, why are we in the situation we're in the first place? It's only because of Fed policy. So they're saying we're in uncharted waters and we've got no experience and no predictive models for this scenario. Not that the Fed's models have proven to be particularly accurate. That's a different comment. But inflation higher than we more persistent than we anticipated should be bullish for gold. The Fed saying we don't have the faintest clue what we're doing, I've translated, that should be extremely bullish for gold. But instead, the market simply said, simply heard interest rate hike. And of course, they didn't even hear the 2 years out. And that, of course, is negative, negative for gold.
Okay, so that's the near term or at least the short term driver. But one thing that I'm finding very curious in terms of the action just today, again on Thursday, is that on the back of the Fed statement, we did see yields move higher. But then all of a sudden today, yields are giving back all of that. So we are seeing a move back into bonds. Why are investors out there buying bonds, taking that more defensive play, but ignoring gold and continuing to sell off gold?
Well, I mean, partly, of course, it's because the dollar's gone up. So with the dollar rally, again, the dollar's rally, US interest rates, as you know, are already higher than competing rates of, you know, leading nations around the world, whether it's Europe, Japan, or whatever. So if you're an international investor, the US is already offering you a relative advantage in your bond yields. And for the Fed then to say, well, we're going to raise interest rates when no one else in the world is talking about raising interest rates, that's one more reason to get in to get into U.S. assets. So the dollar's gone up. So, you know, I think that's what the key differential between the two is. A higher dollar makes, you know, means people are piling into bonds, but a higher dollar means, you know, that's negative for gold. Other things being equal.
Now, one other aspect we should compare here to gold is the U.S. equity markets, because, look, a lot of the chatter out there was saying that if the Fed gets tighter or winds back some of their monetary policy, that's going to hurt gold, or that's going to hurt the U.S. equity markets. We're seeing some weakness in the markets, but again, compared to the precious metals, nowhere close to that kind of weakness. Again, what's the disconnect? Why are the markets managing to withstand, at least for right now, this slightly more dovish, at least in the narrative sense, Fed?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, as you said, the S&P, you know, the stock market did sell off fairly dramatically when the Fed announcement, when Powell opened his mouth, not so much. So it did sell off, and it recovered, of course, and then today it's come off again. But as you say, nothing compared with the rest of the market. I mean, the plain fact is the Fed talked about raising interest rates maybe 2 years in the future, and they talked about maybe we ought to start thinking about when we might want to start talking about having a discussion about possibly perhaps actually tapering sometime in the future. But they're continuing to print money like crazy. And if they are printing, if there's excess liquidity in the system, that is by definition liquidity in excess of the current needs of the economy, that money has to go somewhere. So, you know, it can go into Bitcoin, it can go into 12-year-old sneakers, but most of it, the bulk of it, is going to go into the stock market. and you know, and not there's a wide disparity in the stock market, as you know, between the high flyers with the highest PE multiples and the highest valuations, and most of the stocks. Most of the stocks are at the at their long term high valuations, but most of the stock market is by no means in bubble territory, in my view. And so, you know, there's a lot of excess liquidity around. It has to go somewhere. I think it just continues to go into the stock market.
You're right, Adrian. And the whole fact there being that there's still a lot of liquidity in the system, even though the Fed is maybe thinking about getting a bit more dovish.
Yeah.
Fact of the matter is there's a lot of money still in that system. And, well, quite frankly, people have realized that it's not worth putting it in your bank account. So they, I think, continue to keep it in these markets. Let's talk about the strategy for investors then when it comes to the precious metals, because gold stocks were, you can argue, weathering the storm fairly well after that Fed day on Wednesday. But today, on Thursday, well, they're outperforming to the downside, unfortunately. GDX is down over 5%. GDXJ is down almost 5%. Even silver, SIL, the silver miners, they're down over 5%. What's the strategy then, Adrian, in your eyes,
yeah,
for precious metals investors?
Good question. And I think, yes, stocks sold off yesterday. But frankly, I was surprised yesterday, and I have to say I was cautiously optimistic that the stocks hadn't sold off as much yesterday. But of course, we didn't see, you know, Asian markets or European markets pick up on the gold trade. And so they sold off. I think that's what it was. And they sold off today. You know, frankly, but gold and silver stocks as a group were not in any way overvalued last month, last week, before they dropped. I think that's something we have to remember, because, you know, you have a totally different strategy if the stocks were already ahead of themselves and now, you know, they've released some steam. They were not. They were fundamentally cheap. You look at the valuation metrics on the XAU. We've talked about this before. It's astonishing. Whether it's price to earnings, yes, some gold companies actually have earnings these days. Price to earnings, price to cash flow, price to free cash flow, price to net asset value, price to EBITDA. On all of those valuations, the senior gold and silver companies are trading in the lower 30 percentile compared with their historical evaluation ranges. And on some of those metrics, they are actually in the lowest 10 percentile. That is crazy when gold is trading. And frankly, even if you're talking about gold trading where it is right now, you know, on a historical basis, go back 15 years, this is still, you know, towards the high end of gold's price range, not the low end. And for the gold stocks to be trading at the low end of their valuations, especially when they are, for the most part, better companies, and we've talked about that before, better companies than they were, is crazy. And so for me, the strategy now is, I mean, really take advantage of the declines and sharp declines in the prices of the best companies. You know, there's a saying, don't buy hamburger when the fillet's on sale. And I've nothing against hamburger, and there's some great junior companies out there. But I mean, if you can buy, let's just say, Barrick at $21, or you can buy Agnico back to under 65, Goldfields at 9:30. You know, these are super companies, solid companies, and the prices are remarkably low. And on the silver side, I mean, Pan American, which is, you know, I think it's the creme de la creme of silver companies, but that's back to its low. I guess it did drop a little bit below it in January. Yeah, a little bit below it in January. But basically, That's at the low price it is traded, you know, for over a year. I think that's just a superb buy at this price for tuna silver under $6. You know, I think if you stick tech, $20. I think if you stick with the best buys, the best companies that are good value, that's the approach right now.
Okay, so you're sticking to the majors, and even looking at the Pan American chart, very interesting because it is testing out really that breakout level from last year and that spike after and right before COVID, actually. It's a very interesting chart to see these bigger guys selling off to what could be some good support levels. What about some of the royalty companies too, Adrian? They've really come off the radar of some investors. There's a lot of royalty companies out there right now, and I know you follow, especially the big ones. Do you like the position that they are in?
Yeah, but, you know, you look at a Franco, it's dropped, you know, less than $4 on a $150 stock price. That hasn't sold off anywhere near as much as the others. So, for example, Franco, I think it's the number one gold mining company out there. It's superb. It's going to do very, very well. But if you're saying today, look at what's dropped, let's scoop up some bargains, then Franco doesn't jump out on your screen. So I think that's true for some of them. Royal Gold has, you know, dropped in line with the market. Osisko's dropped in line with the market. But they were already a little bit ahead of themselves. I think there's more value in some of the junior ones. Metalla, I think, is a good buy here. They announced a very good acquisition this morning. And of course, it was, shall we say, unfortunate timing to make a good announcement when the market crashes like this. But you know, Metalla, it's come back up now. It's at $10, 10 by 10 or 1. But at $10, you know, I think that's a very good buy. They just bought a royalty on IAMGOLD's Côté Gold project, you know, in Ontario. It's being developed. So this is near-term cash flow for them. I think a very, very, very good acquisition for them. So, you know, and Metalla, of course, is in the GDXJ. So there's forced selling. You know, when the GDX is sold, this is sold. So I think that's a good opportunity. One thing I'll say about the royalties, if I may, Corey, and I'm sorry, there's so much to talk about and I'm just jumping around, but one thought that's really interesting about the royalty companies, you know, we know all the advantages of royalties, you know, that they're not responsible for the costs and things going wrong and it's money off the top and all that. And first money in, last money in. And we also know that generally, the valuations have been high, but we accept that because of the quality of the companies. One thing that I think a lot of people haven't really focused on, and that is in an inflationary environment, that gives a real advantage to the royalty companies. Because for Barrick or Agnico or anyone else, when the price of steel and copper go up, that increases the cost of building the mine. And when the cost of energy and the commodity currencies goes up, which they do in inflationary periods, that increases the costs of running the mine. But those costs don't accrue to those increased costs don't accrue to the royalty companies. So the royalty companies have a very strong competitive advantage in an inflationary period, which I don't think there's much doubt that we're entering into.
That does seem to be the overwhelming narrative, too, is that we are in an inflationary period. And the whole question is it transitory or is it not transitory? And quite frankly, we just don't know until further down the road. Final comments then, Adrian. Broadly, in the commodities sector, commodities were volatile heading into this sell-off. And, well, they're all correcting. And even the base metals, quite dramatically. Are you looking outside the precious metals at any other commodities as an opportunity, either within the stocks or the underlying commodity that you think still offers kind of a long-term potential for investors?
Yeah, I'm definitely looking, but I have to say, Corey, today, looking at it today, you know, I mean, And look, Altius, I think Altius, you know, the royalty company, diversified the royalty company, I think that's a very good buy here. Super strong company, and it's, yeah, it gives you broad exposure to all the commodities. But, you know, I've been looking at Cameco and Teck, again, some of the better quality companies in different outside of a precious metal space. And even though they are attractive, in other words, if I'd been sitting here saying, I want to buy Cameco and I want to buy Teck, I'd look today and I say, yep, this is the day to buy them. I don't think the valuations compare with the valuations on the better gold and silver companies. Now, you know, Freeport has come off an awful lot. And Freeport, of course, is the number one copper company to buy. So, you know, I think we can look at those and maybe pick away at them. But the gold, because we may not get another opportunity in some of these metals. But you look at, say, Cameco. You know, Cameco is at whatever it is, $19 or something. Everything's volatile today, so I've got to keep looking. It's 1902 right now. You know, down from a high of 2163. That's the high. Well, okay, that's great, but it was $16 3 months ago, and it was $12 6 months ago. So is it such a super it's not depressed. It's not a highly depressed company right now. And that goes for a lot of the non-precious metal resource stocks, frankly. They're not depressed.
Okay, so you are still seeing some opportunities, though, in some of those major gold miners especially. We're going to leave it there, Adrian. It's always great having you on the show. I appreciate you spending some time with us for this weekend show. And yeah, you know what? We are going to book another interview. Hopefully it is not during another correction, but it is eerie how this does seem to happen to us. Adrian, thanks as always for your time, buddy. It's great having you on the show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Adrian Day, as we did focus a bit more on the resource and commodity sector and the sell-off that we saw today. In these next two segments, I am chatting with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. That's read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. He also has a retail newsletter called In the Know Trader, and also a relatively newer newsletter called 7-Eleven, where Rick picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs. Now, Rick, let's talk big picture here and focus a bit more on U.S. equity markets first, post-Fed. Now, look, the Fed came out with a statement that I guess was a little more hawkish, but really all they said was they are thinking about talking about raising rates, and quite frankly, the dot plot changed, but it changed about 2 years out. So again, it's hard to predict month over month, let alone 2 years down the road. The interesting thing, though, is we saw a bit of selling creep into every market, but it seems like the U.S. equity markets are withstanding that selling pressure almost better than any other sector or market within the U.S. Rick, how's that happening? Why are the U.S. markets withstanding this slightly more hawkish Fed?
Well, Corey, I think you've got a couple of issues here that need to be addressed. One you touched on, which is the Fed spoke about possibly raising rates 2 years out in two of the quarters, and which the market wasn't looking for based upon the last Fed statement. However, to, you know, I think Jay Powell was kind of smart in how he did this, because he presented this as the possibility that 2 years out there may be some rise in Fed funds rates. And there's no changes now. They're holding things at 0%, or, you know, between 0 and 0.25%. This, I think, was kind of cleverly done as nothing changing for now, but a couple years out, things may be different. And along that, you know, he said inflation was higher for this year than the Fed had expected. So let's start with that. The Fed is known historically and notoriously for being behind the curve. And what I mean by that is being behind what the market knows. So the market has priced in inflation going back as early as, I'd say, last September or so. Investors started leaning towards positioning themselves for inflation down the road. And we've been telling our institutional clients since last September that investors have shifted towards an outlook for inflation. The Fed has not addressed what the market kind of felt like was coming. Interest rates, obviously, on the long end had moved up significantly from last fall. And the U.S. 10-year got to, I think, 1.76 or so was the high of the move, sitting now at 1.45. But the marketplace expected rates to move higher because of inflation. And the Fed kept saying, we're not really concerned about inflation, until this last meeting where they said, you know what, yeah, it is higher than we expected it to be by a significant amount. What's gone on since Wednesday, especially on the yield side, is first a quick move up to, I don't know, what was it, 160 or so, 1.6, and then right back down. So there is a movement here in buying bonds, and part of this, I think, is flight to safety with stocks looking a little iffy, and we'll get to the stock market in a second. But bond yields are just a tad lower than they were on the lows in March, which I think got to 1.47, and now we're at 1.4, actually right now we're at 1.44. Or 4.5. So, you know, we're kind of right there. If we break further, then yields can go down to 138, 128. And if we really had more of a decline in yields, and I'd love it to happen, because if I had the chance to be able to get to sell bonds back with yields beneath 1.2%, I'd be a very happy camper. And I'd relish the opportunity to be able to get that to happen. So for, you know, your listeners, my view is if yields really fell another 20 basis points, 25 basis points, I think that's your last chance you're going to get to sell bonds. And then rates will ultimately make their way higher. So to me, I am a bond bear. And it's just a matter of, you know, of course, like anything else in these markets, timing the best time to put that trade on. But with the high that we have in place at earlier this year in March, which was accompanied by a DeMarc sequential upside exhaustion signal. So, you know, we've kind of been in the camp that rates were going to stall. And now that they've pulled back, good, let them pull back more. And then, you know, I'll probably sell out of all bonds I own, any mutual funds, any type bond funds I have. You get me down near 1.25%, and that's it. I'm done with bonds. I don't think we're going back to 1% or anything like that.
Rick, let me jump in here. Does that mean that the whole defensive trade, you're not buying into that? Or should bonds not be looked at as a defensive trade in this environment?
Well, I think bonds are always going to be looked at as an alternative. They're not necessarily, look, for 30 years, you made money buying bonds. I think that's done with. So putting money into the bond market now is simply a hedge about really being exposed to other markets, most especially the stock market, but it could be some other markets too. So to me, bonds are a place to park money where you don't think you're going to get your rear end handed to you. However, that is more of a short-lived type thing, because I think bonds are done on the downside. You know, we got to, I don't know, 40 basis points or so. I think it was last summer. That's the bottom. And we, you know, we made a good bounce up. We're correcting some of it. The marketplace has been short bonds for a while now because a good portion of Wall Street was expecting rates to go higher, and they did. But, you know, we've gone nowhere in the bond market basically since mid-March. And now there's only so long you go sideways before one of the two sides of that trade starts to feel some pain. And in this case, you know, people who are short bonds are feeling some pain. And, you know, yields have backed up as there's a little bit of a short squeeze. If the short squeeze continues, good. Let people come in and buy bonds as their hedge against what's going on elsewhere. I don't think bonds are a good long-term investment any longer. And I've been saying that for a while. And at this point, just it's a matter of where you want to come in to, from my view, sell out of your bonds for good, because we should be in a higher interest rate environment for the next several years. So to me, you know, the bull market, the 30-year bull market is done.
Okay, let's carry that over to the stock market then. What do you think about the markets? Again, withstanding this slightly more hawkish Fed and the sell-off in a lot of other markets, but not so much still. U.S. equity markets are very close to all-time highs.
Yeah, I mean, it was just Monday of this week, Corey, that the S&P notched a new high from, you know, just barely above last Friday's high. So even though we've had a pretty lousy week in the market, we've had both today and Wednesday were significant down days. We're still only about, you know, just over a percent and a half from all-time highs. So in S&P terms, the market has still held up. So I'm not, I don't have any major concerns yet. From a pure tactical point of view, the first support level is right near today's low. It's 41.78. Today's low is 41.72 as we speak. The market's at 41.86. So we have bounced even from that level. Bigger level to be concerned about is breaking under 41.40 and doing so properly. So we kind of have some filters that we use to help determine if a breakdown or a breakout is real as compared to just market noise. And even though in the month of May, multiple days we were beneath 41.40, none of those days were set up the correct way such that, you know, we really weren't concerned and the market turned around and made new all-time highs. So I'd still use kind of that 41. Let me see what the actual number is. It's 41.43. You've got to break beneath it properly. If you want to know how to break beneath it properly, become a subscriber to In the Know Trader. And we talk about this and have all our clients understand how these kind of market modifications work to better increase the odds that what you're seeing is a real move instead of a fake move. From a little bit longer term point of view, those are tactical numbers. If I switch to a weekly chart, the weekly chart doesn't break until you get under 39.56. And same thing, you would have to break 39.56 correctly. That's a couple hundred points off of the S&P high. And all that does is really bring you back to March level. So it's, you know, even if we get down to the mid-3900s, you haven't done huge damage to the market. Yeah, it's a couple hundred S&P points, which these days is 5%. But 5% is still not any big, you know, thing to be concerned about. And the market, you know, maybe just looking for an excuse right now, and rates, you know, not being able to climb back up over 1.6 may have some people thinking that, you know, they can still head somewhat lower. And if they head lower, it may take the stock market with it right now. There's, you know, there's kind of backwards thinking on certain ways of looking at the market. If yields move significantly higher, it's not good for technology stocks. if yields move lower, it's actually good for, you know, the growth type names, but not necessarily good for the rest of the market, which is what you've seen tech do rather well recently, after being, you know, topping several months ago in relative terms. Tech's actually had a decent time in the last week or two. So rates coming down is good for tech names. And tech is still the biggest part of the market. So you have to think about, too, when you look at the movement in the S&P, what pushes the S&P? Well, it's going to be the largest weighted sectors in the S&P. It's not going to be, you know, staples and energy, despite the fact that energy is by far the best performing sector this year. Energy only makes up 2.9% of the S&P's weighting.
Or so, meme stocks, right? It's not the meme stocks supporting it.
Yeah. I mean, BlackBerry getting squeezed is not going to, you know, make the S&P go higher. If Apple got squeezed, if Amazon got squeezed, yes, because they represent such a large weighting in the S&P. But these little names, you know, getting squeezed, Clovis, you know, getting pushed to $20 or 22, whatever it was a week ago, is not, and now it's down at like 12, is not going to affect the S&P. So, yeah, the meme stocks are not really putting, you know, any major effect on the market average.
All right, Rick, let's talk about the U.S. dollar and combine that with commodities, too, because commodities, they were one of the more volatile sectors, even heading into this week, at the start of this week, really throughout this month. Commodities have started to sell off. Now, big picture, that's after a pretty epic run in almost every commodity over the last year at different times. But the commodities are getting hit very hard on the back of, I guess, that Fed statement, or maybe it was just technically needed a bit of a correction here, although this is a very fast correction in something like gold. Balance that out with the U.S. dollar that also looks like it's put in a bottom and has started to head higher this week. How are you balancing the two here?
Yeah, so tactically, the dollar would do for a rally simply because in and around the 90 level in the dollar index continued to hold as support for a month, accompanied by multiple daily and weekly downside exhaustion signals. So, you know, I had told clients tactically, you probably want to be long the dollar. Strategically, I'm not sure you want to be long the dollar. It's, you know, right now with interest rates coming back down, the dollar's gotten some strength. When a market like the dollar, so we're talking the dollar in any related currency or any related market to the dollar, so that in many ways would be the precious metals, when they trade sideways for a month or more, you typically have a buildup. Think about what sideways market means. It means you have buyers and sellers coming together. There's a lot of liquidity, but the market's not moving. You know, it's trading in a range. When you get a market like that that trades in a very tight range like the dollar did, 50 pips either side of, let's say, 90 in the dollar index for a month or so, you've built up a lot of pressure. Think of it like a pot that's boiling and has a lid on it, and at some point the lid's going to blow. You often see these very swift moves occur as a news event or a perceived change in fundamentals occurs. And this is what you're seeing now in the dollar. The dollar index is at 92.20, so it's moved up 2 full points. That's a very significant move in a very short time. And that's what you're seeing. Gold, for instance, you know, gold's come off $100 in I think it's this week. That's a very significant move in a short time. So, you know, gold topped just over $1,900. If you move $100, that's over 5%. So it's a quick move fast. What happens is the people who have been in these tight trading ranges and created some of the open interest in the futures markets, you know, futures markets are very leveraged, often to the tune of 20 to 1. So if you're on the wrong side of that trade, as so many people are, as sideways patterns develop, you get a lot of people who are starting to lose money very quickly. And the loss of money forces them out, which forces others out, and you get these, you know, quick moves. And you're seeing that in the case of, you know, dollar-denominated things have become more expensive in the last week. And therefore, commodities generally, which are very dollar-sensitive, have come off hard. Look at what's happened to copper. Look at what's happened to lumber. The grains have come off very hard. Several were limit down. If I'm not mistaken, soybeans in the last couple of days removed, I think, the entire year's rally. So you know, things move very quickly as markets adjust. And the dollar strength here, to me, is tactically warranted. And we probably have some more room to go. And certainly I can make the case that we get back towards 93, which was the top of the range from early April. So we certainly could go there, if not even push through there to even squeeze more dollar shorts. And remember, the dollar made its low in the first week in January. And we've talked about this before, Corey. The entire street, from a strategic point of view, came into 2021 being bearish to the dollar. And it basically made its low the first week of the month, of the year. And has not gotten down there since. It got close, you know, just in May, but we didn't make a new low. So the low of the year is from the first week in January, which means that every, you know, dollar shorts are basically on the wrong side of the market. And they're getting squeezed. And this is very reminiscent to 2017. So when Trump won the election in 2016, in November of 16, people got very bullish the dollar. And coming into 2017, just before he got inaugurated, there was a massive, in fact, the most one-sided bullish trade across the institutional marketplace was to be bullish the dollar coming into 2017. The dollar made its high the first day of 2017 and sold off the entire year. So far, this year is the exact opposite. The street was very bearish. If you looked at the strategists' calls for 2021, virtually everyone was bearish the dollar. Well, the dollar's made the low the first week of the year and has not been back. And, you know, you have the chance here for a bigger squeeze. Now, strategically, at some point, I'll be looking to sell into the rally. At this point, I could make the case for 93.76 in the U.S. dollar index as a place to potentially do that, which is slightly higher than the highs from early April, just to run stops above there too. But the street is wrong about the dollar right now. And if that's the case and the dollar continues higher, it's going to keep a lid on some of the commodities. So longer term, I still like gold. And I actually bought some gold yesterday for myself right around here, about 1775 or so. I bought the equivalent, you know, GLD when gold futures were down here. And just, I bought a little bit more. Wasn't a big position. But I've been building into gold for years. And, you know, I took a quick $100 pullback as an opportunity to buy a little more. But it's not something I expect to make money on overnight. Gold is, you know, still a partial hedge. These days, some people are using cryptos for that. If you want, we can talk about that in a second. But you've got to, if you have exposure to the commodity markets, which you do, by the way, if you're long energy names, right? So the question is, has crude oil put in a top at a little over $72 a barrel? You know, is that the near-term high as the dollar finds strength? And, you know, we're seeing now oil's up half a buck today at 71, I don't know, 71.30 or so. But oil has, you know, been moving up steadily all year. In fact, obviously since last April when it got to the ridiculous negative prices, oil's moved up. But you were at $40 oil last November, and you're at $70 oil now. Does this thing keep going and going, or will a rally in the dollar put a, you know, a lid on it for now? And I think it probably does. So I don't expect oil to go much higher. And if oil puts in a lid, then, you know, XOP, OIH, any of the oil-related names and mutual funds and ETFs are going to put, you know, have some type of lid on it. And it doesn't necessarily mean that Wednesday's high is the high for the move, but it's very possible that dollar strength is going to lead to some capping of what commodities can do. And, you know, we've seen it in the actual raw commodities, but now you might start seeing it in some of the energy-related stuff, despite the fact that energy is the best performer this year and will continue to be the best performer all year. And I have no doubt that the S&P Energy Index, which is up more than double any other index of the 11 macro sector indices this year, will continue throughout the balance of the year to be the best performing sector. Nothing's going to come close to energy this year in relative terms, but you still may have some downside exposure over the near term for, you know, a pullback in oil and commodities in general.
Okay. Interesting there, Rick. And big picture, I guess, circling back around to your first answer there in terms of the Fed downplaying inflation and the markets being ahead of the Fed and betting on inflation picking up, are we starting to see the opposite happen now with commodities moving down, dollar moving up? Maybe the market's saying that inflation trade, at least in the near term, has peaked?
I think for now, yes. And I think the markets were also way ahead of themselves, like on the commodity side, where prices have made, you know, price of corn, the price of basic commodities have made such a significant up move. And look, the price of lumber, and you can't, you know, there are a couple of very lightly traded ETFs that somewhat relate to the price of wood and lumber. The lumber futures market is very illiquid, and I don't recommend any of your clients trade it. Even professionals who trade it, there's too many locked limit days that happen in lumber. And it's because it's so thin, it hardly trades. The price of lumber got so high that it was actually pricing people out of being able to buy homes because the raw goods have started to make a material dent into builders' estimates on what new housing is going to cost, and it trickles down now to the buyers. So buyers have been forced out simply because home pricing, not only because of COVID in the suburbs, has gotten much more lofty as people wanted to leave the big cities and get into the suburbs, but also the price of new housing has gotten out of control because the raw prices of cement, copper, and lumber. So I think the commodity side was overdone. You're seeing a correction, and the correction should likely last some more. So for the near term, yes, the inflation play is probably over. But I don't think it's done for good. I think it's just done for now. We should see inflation still creep in over time, and at some point, the U.S. 10-year is going to 2% and higher, and, you know, it's the Fed's going to have a hard time dealing with inflation.
Fair. Well, they say it's still transitory, right? They're using that argument that don't worry about it. No one knows for sure, but.
No, but even this, my son just got home for Father's Day from Ohio State, where he graduated, but he's staying for grad school. And he just got home. I haven't seen him in months, and it was great seeing him. And he was telling me that he's seeing a big difference in the price of his grocery shopping. And, you know, he's a 22-year-old who is a young adult and first, you know, starting to now be on his own and shop for himself and you know, pay for his own things. And when you're a kid, you don't realize this. But now that, you know, he's, as a young adult, doing his own shopping and seeing that, he said, even the price of salmon, he said he normally buys salmon for, you know, I don't know, $8 a pound, and now he's paying $12 a pound for the same thing. And I said, boy, that's a big, you know, inflation's up, but and causing prices higher in the supermarket, but that sounds like a little too much of a, you know, that's a 50% move per pound. But it is creeping into, you know, your food bill. And you go to restaurants, their costs between COVID and their raw costs have gone up, and they're passing them on as they need to. Inflation is here. You're not going to see restaurants and supermarkets lower their prices. So unfortunately, I think for the consumer, it may not be in the markets, and we'll see a correction in the markets. But on the consumer end, other than the possibility that gasoline could come down, you know, if oil fell from 70 to 60, you should see your gasoline get a little cheaper. But other than that, I think for the consumer, once inflation creeps into the environment, it shows up in prices, and the consumer is on the short end of the stick here because people are, you know, suppliers are not likely to lower prices. If yields go from, you know, from what was as high as 1.75 and get down to, let's just say they went to even 1.25, you're not going to see that correction show up as in the consumer side and not pay any less. If prices have moved up, they're going to stay there. And only over time will they go higher. They're not going to come back down.
Fair enough, Rick. It's an interesting market out there, isn't it? And everybody had their eye on the Fed, and the Fed really didn't do much, but boy, oh boy,
no, they really didn't. Reaction. And that's the thing. They really didn't do much, Corey. They did a smart job at how they presented this. No changes now, nothing for maybe 2 years, and the market's getting spooked on something that may or may not be 2 years down the road. I think, if anything, it was the reaction to them saying, oh, yeah, there's like almost a full percent more of inflation than we thought there'd be.
Yeah, finally. That aspect of it, right? But the Fed's been wanting higher inflation, but that's just how wild and crazy these markets are. But again, the Fed, whether you like it or not, carries a heavy hand in the market. And they even said they're going to talk the markets to death even before making a policy decision. So, hey, here's the start of it, I guess. Rick, we're out of time, buddy. It's great having you on the show. Thank you very much for taking time on this weekend show. I'll have you back on in probably a month's
My
time,
pleasure.
And we'll recap everything and any other changes that we're seeing. But this month, June, has been a pretty, I think, key reversal month for such things as the dollar and commodities. Rick, thanks as always for your time, buddy. Have a great rest of your weekend.
You too, Corey. Thanks for having me.